Okay, here's our logo. Just to remind you that we are making all this red stuff, and we're going through what is the red stuff. We've seen water is the most abundant. We learned a lot about water. And we're stepping through the four classes of macromolecules, and while we're doing it, we're considering most of the small molecules that are the monomers that make up the polymers that are the macromolecules. And we've done polysaccharides, and we've just started lipids. And so let's continue with lipids. So the first class of lipids we're talking about are fats, which are made up of two kinds of monomers. There's a kind of a backbone. It's a very different kind of structure than polysaccharide, not really macromolecules as such when you consider the individual fat molecules. So we have this polyalcohol with three OHs, a glycerol, and onto each of those glycerols, and we did this last time, I just briefly recapitulate. We're going to react with an acid to form a new functional group, the ester, which is acid, an acid, any kind of acid, plus any kind of alcohol or OH group. You form this group, CO, and in this case, this is a carboxylic acid ester, a carboxylic acid ester, right? And so we have what's left of the carboxylic group and what's left of the alcohol group. That's a new group called the ester. And this fatty acid length could be variables often around 18 or 20. So they're quite long, longer than octane, and very hydrophobic, even though they have this kind of little bit polar end on one end. So you continue with this addition first to one of the OHs, then to the other OHs, and finally to the third OH, until you have three fatty acids attached to this glycerol. These are now no longer glycerol, but glyceride. And since you have three, you have triglycerides. So fats are triglycerides. You have triglycerides is one of the things that's looked for in a routine blood test. In a physical exam, you could have a diglyceride and a monoglyceride. Are those fats? I don't consider them fats, but it's arguable. I like to keep it clean. The triglycerides are the fats, and that's the way you find them. So here's a picture overlaid now. This is all from handout 2.9. So this is actually very, very kind of a small fatty acid. You see you have all these CH2 groups, and then there's this variation on a theme in which a couple of hydrogens less are here because a double bond forms and you only have four bonds to carbon. So you have a double bond here between two of the carbons, and there could be multiple double bonds. There's still no separation of charge here because of different electronegativity, so this doesn't affect the hydrophobicity of the molecule. But it does affect the structure of the molecule in three-dimensional space. Here we are again in three-dimensional space. So those fatty acids and those fats that have fatty acid residues in them that have no double bonds, they have the maximum number of hydrogens they could have. They're just saturated with hydrogens, which is kind of a silly term to be saturated with these atoms. But that's the term that's used, and that's your saturated fat. So saturated fat means a triglyceride that doesn't have any of these double bonds. It has the maximum number of hydrogens it could have. Whereas this guy, with this one double bond, has two less hydrogens than a saturated fatty acid of the same length. And so since it could have more, if you could only add hydrogen across those bonds, hydrogenate it, could, then it would be saturated. So as such, however, it's unsaturated. And it could have many of these double bonds, or three, let's say, double bonds, that already becomes polyunsaturated. So these are terms you see in the popular press. So let's talk about these double bonds. A little bit. There's free rotation about all single bonds in organic chemicals, but if you have a double bond between two carbon atoms, you cannot rotate around that. There's no rotation. So there's right away a big difference in the configuration this fatty acid can take in space. This guy can dance around. You remember that semi-animation of the glucose ring changing, and there was a lot of gyrations and differences in position of the carbon atoms within the molecule. They could fold up, they could stretch out. And here you have some constraint because you can't rotate around this bond. So you have some small constraint compared to this guy. But that turns out to be important. The way I've drawn this, we have the C double bond C, and I have the rest of the molecule here coming off in the two directions, both on the same side of this carbon-carbon double bond. Now, I could have written a carbon-carbon double bond the other way. I think maybe we have this next. Let me get ahead of myself. No, I'll be getting ahead of myself. The fact is that when you find these double bonds in triglycerides, in fats, they are in this configuration, which is called cis. So the other possibility is that this bond to the rest of the molecules on the other side of the double bond compared to the carbon that has the other one with the rest of the molecule. Easier to see here. Same is true for the hydrogens. These hydrogens are on the same side. And so this is called a cis configuration. If I had been up here, it would be called trans. So every time you have a C-C double bond, you can have it either in cis or in trans. And since those two molecules will not be superimposable, they're distinct molecules, they are, in fact, isomers of each other. Right? And since they're only different in three-dimensional space, they are stereoisomers, in fact, another form of stereoisomers. Anyway, in nature, almost all the double bonds in fats are cis. And so you have this, coming along here, you hit the double bond, you have this kink, which is over here. Now, if you consider these molecules in an aqueous solution, and they're going to be subject to hydrophobic forces, and it's this long 20-carbon, three of them, in one fat molecule, it meets another fat molecule, it's going to coalesce with it, just like those octanes, but even with even greater hydrophobic force. And so this guy, when it comes time to coalesce, after it's collided with another triglyceride, it has all the flexibility in the world with cuddling up with all those and increasing, pushing out the water from those interfaces. Those three fatty acid residues have no trouble interacting with each other and forcing all the water out. Comparatively, this guy has a little bit of trouble because of this kink. So it's not so easy for it to definitely push out all the water. You've got to wait a little longer. By this time, everything's dancing and it's lost its chance. As a result, these saturated fatty acids can coalesce with each other so well that as it happens, at 37 degrees, the body temperature of us, or room temperature, about, 22 degrees, they coalesce so much and so with such hydrophobic force they become solid, and it's solid fat. So that's butter or marbleized beef, which is what we have in us. The ones that have this unsaturated, even a single bond, especially if they have more, can't get together with such force, and they do get together and they form just like water molecules get together, not a gas at room temperature, they form a liquid because of their interaction. They still have plenty of interaction, and so they are a liquid. So the hydrophobic forces are pushing them to be a liquid, and they're oil. So that's the difference between fat and oils, unsaturated fatty acids. You sort of knew this, right, from the popular literature. And that's the difference between fats and oils. The advantage to having solid fat, if you're a mobile organism, multicellular organism, like a fly or a person, you can make all this. This fat is a storage. That's it. The role of fat is to store energy. Fat has a lot of energy that can be derived from it, which we'll see when we get to energy metabolism. And so if it's solidified, it's very compact, and you're in control of it, sort of where it is. It stays where it is, not flopping around and swishing around all in your body if we had oils instead of fat. Plants, on the other hand, they don't care if it's oil. It might even be an advantage. They just sit there and can move this oil around where they need it, perhaps, And so the plant fat is usually oil, and animal fat is usually solid. Sometimes, now we get to the marketplace and we have this oil, canola oil, or cotton seed oil, or corn oil. Since fat's not so solid fat's not so good for you in the sense that it can agglomerate onto the inside of your arteries and give you atherosclerosis, it's not good for you. So you try to eat oils to be healthy, which are less likely to do that. And on the other hand, people haven't gotten used to dipping their bread in olive oil, but rather they like to spread something on. So it became popular then to take an oil, so you wouldn't have to be eating butter with all its solid fat, and convert it into a solid. And so you can do that by a catalyzed chemical reaction. In this case, the catalyst is platinum metal. And we'll look at that also a little later. But with platinum metal and a lot of under the right conditions, you can take this oil and extract the two hydrogens, reduce it, it's called. Take out the hydrogens and add hydrogens. With hydrogen gas and platinum and these double bonded carbon molecules, you will add hydrogen at a quick rate. And then you will hydrogenate it. So you look at your peanut butter label. It says hydrogenated. I think it'll be peanut oil, but it's usually corn oil, and they add peanuts. Or you look at your margarine or Crisco, right? Crisco, just oil. And they add hydrogens, and they make it a solid. So during that process, that's kind of a reversible reaction, that adding of the hydrogens here. So you add them, and then you take them out, and then you add them, and on balance, you have added them, and it becomes solid. There's still a lot of the unsaturated oil right in there mixed in with the Crisco. Right? But because it goes back and forth now, and because this is just a rather crude catalyst, this platinum, doesn't have this fussiness that the biological catalysts, which are enzymes, have. When it puts the hydrogens, when it takes the hydrogens away, it could take them away and form either cis or it could form trans. So you started out with all cis and now you have mostly, you have a lot of the saturated, but those that are unsaturated now are about 50-50 that are left because the reaction is going back and forth, cis and trans. So you have this new situation, which you don't find very often in nature, you do find it a little bit, of trans fatty acids. So this is sort of instructive in a way. So whereas the cis has these two hydrogens, which is easier to see, but you can also consider it these left-hand group and the right-hand group, both on the same side of the double bond, and you get this kink. If you have a trans, you still have that double bond in there, but now there's not so much of a kink. It seems to go straight through. There's still a little, you still can't rotate around this, but it's not producing such as big a disturbance in an impediment for these fatty acid parts of the molecule to cuddle up, right? Because they can just, these two flat ones just get together. You don't have to wait for something to swing around. So the trans fatty acids, you know, tend to be solid, like the saturated fatty acids, the trans unsaturated fatty acids. Very hard to keep this straight, you know, unsaturated. You just have to work it out in your mind each time. I still have to. So I used to, I've been teaching this for a long time, and I used to say trans fatty acids, it's as bad for you as solid fatty acids, because they can form solids. So there's no point in eating these trans fatty acids. It's actually a bad thing. Then people started talking about, you know, trans fatty acids, you know, are really, not only are they bad, they're actually worse for you than the solid. I couldn't understand that, because they're probably, you know, not quite as bad as the solid fat, because they do have this slight constraint. In any case, they shouldn't be any worse in getting together by my explanation. So I doubted it. And then the mayor banned them from New York City, so I had to look into it more carefully. And I could not find a reason from my logic here to explain it. On the other hand, I did find many epidemiological studies, not many, but several, in which I looked at people who ate a lot of trans fat, and sure enough, they got heart disease, died more often than people who did not. I couldn't argue with it. So I don't understand it. I'm not sure anybody understands it. You could think up reasons. Perhaps the fat here is really broken down very fast, so you have a certain amount, you eat a lot of it, you're in trouble. And this guy maybe is not metabolized. I mean, that's a convenient explanation, but I haven't seen any evidence for that. So that's where I stand on trans. I believe it, but I don't understand it. Nevertheless, you now understand my original argument that it shouldn't be any worse than solid fat in terms of the biophysical chemistry behind it. Fat, as I said, its function is a storehouse for energy, much like glycogen. Right? It's stored in a special adipose tissue, in mammals at least, and this tissue has cells in it that have this special organelle, which is this flat globule right inside the cell. There's the nucleus. And you have a much bigger region in the cell. It just contains all this fat. And when you need, and you start to starve, like around 5:30, you'll start to mobilize this fat to give you energy to walk to the store to buy more food. It's got about, as we will see, it's got about twice the calories of starch. So that is, gram for gram or pound for pound. So whereas I told you about that glycogen giving me energy while I was running, that's okay for a quick shot of glucose to keep you going. But for long-term storage, it would be much less compact. If you would have, I weigh on a good day about 163. I would have to weigh about 195 if I were using glycogen if I were using glycogen rather than fat as my storehouse for energy. Okay, that's fat. Now, this very similar structure with one important change gives us phospholipids, extremely important lipid, and much more interesting in a way than this storehouse role. So, in phospholipids, we're going to put two fatty acid molecules onto this glycerol backbone, but we're going to reserve this bottom one, or could be the top one, it's symmetrical. We're going to reserve this bottom one for a phosphate group. So here's our first talk about an inorganic molecule. There's no carbon in this. This is the salt, or the ion, produced by phosphoric acid. This phosphoric acid would have an H here. So you have three OHs around the phosphate. This is an extremely strong acid, like sulfuric acid. It's extremely, it loses this hydrogen, it loses this hydrogen, pretty much, it even starts to lose this one. So it's generally at least somewhere between 2 and 3 negative charges in the phosphate ion. I should say and we'll see this more when we talk about amino acids in a few minutes, that biologists tend to talk about something that's an acid in terms of its ionized salt form. So instead of phosphoric acid, we say phosphate. Phosphate, strictly speaking, from a chemical term, doesn't have the hydrogens, could take them up, and in the chemistry course might be considered the base. But since most biology takes place at pH 7, so we know if you put phosphoric acid and you buffer it at pH 7, it's going to, these things, because it's a strong acid, are going to be charged, and we're really talking about the phosphate ion. We use the terms interchangeably. So a carboxylic acid or a carboxylate. We biologists are loose in this way and use them interchangeably. And this will come up and will confuse some of you. So I say it now and I'll say it again. So I'm going to say phosphate here. So here's, and I've drawn it as phosphate and with one charge. So the phosphate with this one remaining OH. And you shouldn't worry about this OH because, in the next microsecond, there's going to be an H here, briefly. So you could react with this one, too. These three are equivalent. It's going to react when it reacts with an alcohol and you take out OH and you condense these two. Where are we going to find an alcohol? Well, right here, this polyalcohol, the one that's left on the bottom, goes together with this. Then you're going to get an acid plus an alcohol. And I told you a little earlier, acid plus alcohol forms an ester. It's not a carboxylic acid ester, as we saw before, for the connection between the fatty acid and the glycerol, but it's an ester nonetheless. It's a phosphoric acid ester. So phosphoric acid plus an alcohol can form an ester. Oh, there it is. Or a phosphoester for short. It's a phosphoester. This could be any organic molecule. This is just a blow-up from that same handout. Now, it doesn't. If it did end there, you would have these two long hydrophobic groups plus R would be H, right? And that would be that's called phosphatidic acid. If R equals H, phosphatidic acid. Not too important. Sometimes that's an I. And that's sort of the most fundamental what? Phospholipid. This is now a phospholipid. And phosphatidic acid is the most fundamental, but usually the reactions go on and different R groups are put here other than H. If it's another alcohol with carbons on it, not just H, then we have used this phosphate since it's kind of a polyacid. It has at least two, if not, it has three really acidic groups in these three OHs in this configuration that can be considered acidic. So we have, again, another ester. So this is not only a phosphoester here, it could be a phosphoester here. And we have two esters, or a phosphodiester. Not diester, phosphodiester. What are these R groups that we find in nature? Okay, so let's say we talked about this one. Water could be considered sort of a primitive alcohol, if you will. But then they get more complicated. This is a very common one. What is that? Well, let's start over here. Here's a molecule with two carbons, like ethanol or ethane, two carbons, and then embellished at the two ends. In one end, it's an OH, so that would make it, in this case, ethanol, this is CH3. But now at the other end, we've put an amino group, and I'm drawing it charged in its charge form here because we know amino groups are charged at pH 7. So that's the same as NH2. It's equivalent. It's NH3+. And so it's ethanol amine. So we started from the left and made it ethanol and added amine. That's what it's called, ethanol amine. And sometimes ethanol amine is this R group. And now we've put, not only is it a negative charge here on the end of something like phosphatidic acid, but we've put now another charge, a positive charge. So the two charges are sort of neutralized. You could think of it that way. Or you could think of it, now it's got two charges. Yeah, they're opposite, but they're still attracting water molecules, very hydrophilic. It's even more hydrophilic because it's got two charges and water can interact with both of them. And this positive charge can be made even stronger, a stronger base, if you start substituting some of these hydrogens. If you start putting methyl groups on the end of it, you could end up with an actual ion, permanent ion, and this has a completely different name that tells you nothing, but it's called choline. Right? And that's probably the most common R group over here. And you can name that, then you could say phosphatidyl up to this point, make an adjective out of phosphatidic acid, choline. Phosphatidyl, ethanolamine. Phosphatidyl, serine, which looks a little similar, except here's a little different arrangement. You have a minus and a plus. This is actually an amino acid, which we'll talk about in a minute. And it's just got this extra polar group. It's got an OH, and that's the one that's going to react. And it's got brings in a negative and a positive. So now we have three charges. We have this guy from the phosphate still there. We have a carboxylic acid, which is charged at pH 7. And we have oppositely charged, but charged nonetheless, amino group on the amino acid, phosphatidyl serine. And there are other ones. These sometimes get a little ornate, but these are major ones. What happens if you if you put all the fat together? What you get is your chicken soup, right? You get this yellow glob floating on the top. If you put phospholipids together, they form kind of a boundary. They coalesce because of hydrophobic forces here. First, laterally here, one with another, with another, with another. Right? But if you think of it more in three dimensions now. And then you have this hydrophobic surface over here, and these guys have already coalesced, say, to make this, oligo something, this fragment. So there's plenty of hydrophobic force if you drug these together, but then we're closed out because this has got, even phosphatidic acid, a bunch of negative charges, and you might say, well, those negative charges can repel each other, but they can't fight this hydrophobic force. You can make such structures out of phosphatidic acid. But perhaps that's the reason, I'm not sure of this, perhaps that's the reason why a positive charge is often put in there. So you have phosphatidylcholine has one positive and one positive from the choline nitrogen and one negative from the phosphate, remaining phosphate O minus. That takes care of this repulsion problem. They could even attract each other if they're lined up right. So if you extend this now in the third dimension coming out at you and behind you, you have formed this sheet which has on its outside the hydrophilic groups, which are now interacting with water. I mean, this is not meant to mean interaction. This is meant to mean penetration. And inside, you have this compartment which is highly hydrophobic. And this is a cell membrane. This is a membrane. And you can make this, you can buy phosphatidylcholine from Sigma Chemical Company, and you can put it in water, and it will form these sheets. So this is the basic structure for all membranes. You're going to learn about the intricacies and the behavior of these membranes in the second semester, but I introduce it here because I'm talking about phospholipids. And they're what's forming this boundary between what's inside the cell and what's outside the cell, and you can't penetrate it if you're a hydrophilic molecule. Even though you can interact with these groups, you can't worm your way in here because you're pushed out immediately by hydrophobic forces. Interestingly, if you are another lipid, let's say a steroid like estrogen can run this gauntlet of this thin gauntlet of charge, and once it gets one end in here, it will zip in. So things like lipids, like fatty acids or steroids, get right into the cell, don't need any special channel because they have no trouble. But most other things, like glucose, for example, you would need a channel to get through this barrier, this hydrophobic barrier. So since the membranes are around all cells, and inside the cells there's more membranes, there's nuclear membrane, there's membranes around the organelles, there's also membranes that I didn't talk about that just run through the cytoplasm, a whole network of membranes. So there's, our cells are, this compartment of hydrophobicity can amount to a very substantial part of the cells, and we tend not to talk about it. We don't understand that as well. Maybe 25%. Oh, what I didn't mention here is this abbreviation. So we can abbreviate phospholipids in this way. They often are. The hydrophilic polar head, a little circle, and then, could be still in black, this jagged line which represents not one fatty acid, but both of the fatty acids, sort of depicted, symbolized as one hydrophobic tail. So you see that here. They look a little more double here. Look at all these functional groups we've talked about now. We started with hydroxyl, then the amine, and amide. And these guys were introduced sort of just to show you examples of hydrogen bonding. Then carboxyl, and the amine and the carboxyl to explain organic acids. The carbonyl, when we talked about sugars, and breaking down that carbonyl into an aldehyde carbonyl and a ketone carbonyl. Now we've talked about carboxylic acid esters, a phosphoester, a phosphodiester. So we're making our way through that list, and we will cover that list, of course, designed to cover all the ones we're talking about. But there aren't really a huge number of functional groups beyond that are of interest in living systems. We've also talked about some new kinds of bonds, the glycosidic bonds, sort of a special kind of sugar-sugar bond, and we've talked about the C-C double bonds. So we're doing a lot of chemistry, if you will, at a superficial level, but enough so that we feel we understand what's going on, right? That's enough for lipids. It's a weird class. You see, they're not these long things. They are these long things. If you consider a membrane, you can actually see huge membranes go on for microns and microns. with, you know, billions of molecules. So in terms of assemblages that, but they're not covalently bonded to each other, these phospholipids. But in that sense, they are sort of like macromolecules. Anyway, it doesn't matter what we call them now. They're there, and we understand them. Now let's turn to class three. We went through polysaccharides and lipids, told you something about the function of both of those classes, various functions, or a few functions for each. Now let's talk about proteins. And we're going to spend a lot of time on proteins. And proteins, in describing their functions, is going to lead us deep into the workings of living cells. So deeply that we're going to take on so many more topics in this story. Remember, we're trying to see what's in the cell. But that's a framework for discussing how things work. So I'm going to spend the rest of my time talking about proteins and their function. And we won't even get to nucleic acids until Professor Moshowitz starts at lecture 10. All right, proteins, what's the monomer? The amino acids. Okay, there's 20 different ones. And they differ in this R group. But the basic structure is that there's an amine. It's an amino acid. It's got a central carbon. And it's got an amine group, which we know is really charged at pH 7. And a carboxyl group. That's the acid. And most of them have a hydrogen at one end, but one doesn't. And then there's an R group, which is different for the 20 different varieties of amino acids that are found in this macromolecule protein. R can be as little as H, which makes the smallest amino acid, and that's glycine, as we'll see. So we're going to talk about some of these as examples. Here I've drawn it in its charged form at pH 7. If a molecule has a positive and negative charge that I think they have to neutralize each other to get this name, they're called zwitterions, which is a delightful word. And they're electrically neutral, but they're charged nonetheless. Right? Sort of like phosphatidic acid. Right? No, phosphatidylethanolamine, phosphatidylcholine. So let's talk a little bit more about this charge. So at pH 7, they actually find both forms. So there's a little bit of this. Just like at pH 7, you find some water that's been lost, that's acted as a weak acid and has lost a proton. You have an OH ion and an H plus ion. And we figured out that at neutral pH, there's about 10 to the minus 7th molar of protons and hydroxyl ions. So it is for the amino acids. If they... this big arrow says they're mostly in this configuration, but if we focus on the carboxylate, for example, it could add a hydrogen ion, or a proton, those are synonymous, and form the uncharged part. But it's mostly like this. It's in equilibrium, and it lies far to the form of the ionized molecule. Let's look at this in more detail. So here we are at pH 7, in graphic 14. The net charge here is 0. Because we have this charge, the vast majority of the molecules, and the carboxylate, and the amine group is also charged in most of the molecules. But suppose now we change the pH. We're in charge. You don't have to look always at what's in the cell, but we can take this amino acid, which we can buy as a solid, put it into solution, and we can put as much acid as we want. We could add hydrochloric acid. And bring the pH up from set of 7, we could bring the pH down to 1, 10 to the minus 1 molar hydrogen ion. Now we're going to shift that equilibrium just by mass action. So we're going to drive with this million times more protons. This cannot help but get protonated. So at pH 1, this guy cannot withstand the onslaught of these hordes of hydrogen ions. And so it's going to be mostly in the protonated, uncharged COOH form. The amine group, on the other hand, of course, loves it here. It's going to stay as an ion. Certainly easy for it to be charged in the presence of so many hydrogen ions. Right? So the result is that pH 1, this amino acid, is not neutral, but has a net charge of plus 1. And we can exploit that sometimes in the laboratory. Similarly, if we add base, like potassium hydroxide, and we're essentially taking away the protons because this KOH, the OH ion, is completely in potassium hydroxide or sodium hydroxide, completely ionized, and that will grab, that's a very strong base, and it will grab all the hydrogen ions. And so you'll be down to, say, pH 11. Instead of 10 to the minus 7th molar, you're now 1,000 times less, 10,000 times less at 10 to the minus 11 molar. And at 10 to the minus 11 molar, this guy's not so strong that it can still hold on to that hydrogen ion, but we'll give it up to these hydroxyls. And it will become uncharged. And we have a net charge then. Of course, the carboxyl will be completely uncharged, having glad to lose its proton to these OH minus ions. And so we'll have a net charge of minus 1. Now, something I feel really belongs in a biochemistry course for the sort of level we're talking, but it's just, I have to at least mention it a little bit. That is, I said, you know, it's glad to it can't hold on to it any longer. Why can't it? Why isn't it as good as OH ion in grabbing these protons, this amine group? Well, it's not as good. So can we quantify that? How good is it compared to an OH ion? Well, we can characterize all these acidic and basic groups for their ability to either gain lose a proton, become like this, or gain a proton and look positively charged like this, by considering what is the pH. If I don't consider these extremes, suppose I put this instead of pH 7, I put it at pH 6 or 5, right? Well, at 6, it still turns out, if we measure it, it turns out to be mostly, even at pH 6, it's still mostly in this uncharged state, that even though we've added 10 times more hydrogen ions, it's strong enough to still lose its hydrogen ion or proton at pH 6. How about pH 5? Yeah, still. pH 4. At some point, it's going to become protonated. At some point, it's going to be 50-50. That's a convenient point. So it's sort of the swing point. What is that pH? That pH is about 2.5. I don't know. Some places I look at it's 3.5. But most places, if I Google this, come up with 2.5. This is called the pH, at which it's 50-50, is called the pK. And the K refers to the equilibrium constant for the protonation reaction. And so we can see that the pK of like OH is probably 0.1 or something. I don't know. It's very strong. But when you get down to pH 2.5, that amount of hydrogen ion, which is somewhere between 10 to the minus 3, right, and 10 to the minus 2, you get this 50-50 point. If it were stronger, this number would be lower. If it were weaker, it would be higher. Like citric acid, like lemonade, it's an acid. It's about pH 5, so it's even much weaker than this. Right? Acetic acid, can't remember. Couldn't be too much because, you know, we eat it. And vinegar. And the same thing up here, we can get a pK value. For the amino group that's attached to this central carbon, it's about pH 9. So these are pretty good acids and bases. You know, they're not as good as sulfuric acid or lye, but they're pretty hefty. We're going to talk about the amino acids. As we did with the sugars, we're going to have to be able to communicate. So let's take this amino acid. It's called lysine. It doesn't help you to know the English word. You don't have to memorize these things. You have to memorize those functional groups. You don't have to memorize these. If I talk about lysine and I want you to do something with the structure, I'll give you the structure if it's an exam. We're talking about it. So lysine has an R group, which is has a bunch of CH2s followed by an amine. Is that amine charged? Of course it's charged. It's an amine at pH 7, usually. We'll call this middle carbon alpha. It's at the starting point of the side chain, alpha. So it follows that the next one is going to be beta. So the alpha one is the one that's attached. And given that this is alpha, if we would talk about the carboxyl group here, we could call it the alpha carboxyl to distinguish it from, well, what? This is the only carboxyl that's there, and so it must be here. But not true for the amino group. There's two amines here, so we have to distinguish them. So this is the alpha amino group, and then there's a beta, gamma, delta, epsilon amino group as well. So we could talk about these two now separately. And in fact, I can never remember how many CH2s there are, but somehow this epsilon amino is a phrase that sticks in my mind, so I can always figure out that it's 4, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. I can draw that structure for lysine instead of looking it up. Here's one way to write, you'll see the amino acids in different books, written in different ways. Here, the R group is to the left, and it's in Courier font. And they also have English names, alanine, and often the English names don't help you. You know, I don't know what the history is. And they have a three-letter abbreviation, which is pretty easy to remember from the English name. Alanine is ALA, arginine is ARG. These are all drawn uncharged. You have to figure out the charge. Okay. Another way you'll see them is like this, where now the R group is where? Down, hanging down, right? So, no. Here it's hanging down. Here, yes, it's hanging down. So here's the basic unit, amine, carbon, COOH. And it's an H usually, and here it's hanging down. Here we see there's a different abbreviation. Besides the three-letter abbreviation, there's a one-letter abbreviation. So glycine, which is the smallest amino acid, has an H here, and it's called gly or G. Alanine is the next biggest. It's got a methyl group here hanging down, and it's called A. But sometimes then they get a little funny. Asparagine is N and glutamic acid is E. So it's a good idea, if you plan to go on to any other biology course, to actually memorize these single-letter abbreviations, because you'll be thrown a graphic or a piece of paper that'll say, you know, A-G-T-W-W-E-N. And you should be able to say, oh, I have to go get my book and look it up, or what is E versus N. It's good to memorize it. We've been chastised by the people who teach the 3,000-level courses for not forcing you to memorize this. But I told you, our philosophy is minimize the memorization. You can just look this up. So I don't think it's so important understanding any concept. But it will be handy to memorize that. I didn't memorize it until I was maybe 50 years old. Even now I have trouble with E and N. Okay, so let's take a look at some of these. The glycine we talked about. Here's a leucine. Now we're going to consider each of these amino acids, and we will be able to infer, even deduce, or figure out their properties. These are going to be all held together, as you'll see, in a polypeptide, so that we're not going to have to worry too much about these alpha amino and alpha carboxyl. They're going to be tied up and not going to be charged. So we can consider how one amino acid differs from the other is in its side group. So something like leucine, as CH2C, CH3CH3, it's got a hydrophobic side group, and it's considered a hydrophobic amino acid. So that was easy. Look at this guy. This is they're all unique, but this is an unusual amino acid in that, what is this? This is, remember the steroid abbreviation? CH2, CH2, CH2. So where's the, and there's the alpha carbon, right? Let's look at it. Let's look at this more clearly. Here's the alpha carbon. Here's the alpha carboxyl. Here's the alpha amino. And the alpha amino is actually bonded to something here. It's not free. As you go down, here's the side chain. Here's the H. Here's the side chain. You go CH2, CH2, CH2. It's sounding pretty hydrophobic. And then instead of dangling in air, it is connected to this N over here. This is shown in the charge form. So if it weren't charged, it would be NH instead of NH2. But it's got a proton on there. So this one's lost. So I'm sort of jumping between the charged and uncharged, not to be confusing, but to make sure that you're able to do it. Proline, pro, or P. So this is hydrophobic also, very hydrophobic, and it has this strange doubling back on itself character. Here's methionine, which brings in a whole new element we haven't seen before, sulfur. Two of the amino acids have sulfur. This is one of them. This is still pretty hydrophobic, even though sulfur is similar to oxygen. You'd think it would be electronegative. It's not so electronegative as oxygen. Anyway, this turns out to be hydrophobic. Here's serine, which got an OH, so that's only got one little CH2 here. So this is mostly polar. It's like an alcohol. Now we have a side chain that's got a full-fledged charged carboxyl group here, shown uncharged, but you know it's charged. So this is an acid, and it helps you to know the name by knowing the name aspartic acid, or aspartate as the salt. So aspartate is abbreviated D, and because A is already taken by alanine, and is one of the two charged, fully charged amino acids. The other one's going to be glutamate, which isn't on here, glutamic acid. Oh yeah, right here. So it's very similar. Aspartate's got two CH2s before you hit the carboxyl. This one has only one, a little longer. Glutamic acid or glue or what? E, right? Yeah. Now this is a variation on aspartic acid, in which instead of a COOH, you now have CONH2. What is that? Looks familiar. That's the amide. It's the amide. So the amide, as I emphasized when I introduced it in the very first or second lecture, for a great hydrogen bonder, extremely polar, can make hydrogen bonds all over the place, but is not charged. This is not an amino group. It's part of this whole amide group. Glutamine for glutamic acid is as an analogous variation. Glutamine, which is a Q. Skip one. Arginine brings us a whole new functional group. There's another new one we're not going to meet until a little later. Look at this guy, NH2, CNH, NH2, all these nitrogens. It's a very strong base, stronger than an amino group, and the positive charge is just distributed among intermediate structures or structures that are, depending how you look at it, are in equilibrium with each other. But basically, the positive charge, whereas I said the amino group was a pK of 9, this is more like a pK of 10 or 11. So it's very strong, but it's positively charged, right? So we have lysine and arginine are two positively charged ionized side groups, and aspartic acid and glutamic acid are the two ionized acidic, negatively charged side groups. Histidine, we're not going to deal with this too much, but this turns out this is a ring, and you see it's got some nitrogens in it, the rest are carbons, and this actually can get protonated at around about half protonated at pH 6. So at pH 7, it's about 10% protonated. We're not going to dwell on that. I'm not going to use that fact here, but if you take biochemistry, it's very important, actually. That ability to be near neutral pH, to have a lot of the side chains on the edge of being protonated or not, turns out to be handy in chemical reactions where it can grab a proton, but not hold it too tightly, give it up. Grab it and give it up. So histidine is good for chemical reactions. Tyrosine is a good example of the ambiguity of these side chains. Okay, yeah, leucine is hydrophobic, serine is hydrophilic. What about tyrosine? You'll pick up different introductory texts and they'll be classified. You know, tyrosine in one text will be, well, it's obviously polar because there's OH. Another text will say, no, it's obviously hydrophobic because of these 6-7 CH2 groups. I favor the latter. I think this is mostly hydrophobic and mainly colored by my laboratory work. When I was young, trying to make a solution of tyrosine, it's very hard to get tyrosine into the solution. So it has these dual characters, what can we say? It's mostly hydrophobic, but it has this hydrophilic end, right? Much like the fatty acid, although not as extremely hydrophobic. Look at tryptophan. This is a big ring. This is the largest. Glycine is the smallest. This is the largest amino acid. It's 75 molecular weight. It's about 200 and something, 203, I think. And this is mostly hydrophobic, although like histidine, it could get charged at moderate pH, but we'll consider it hydrophobic, even harder to get into solution. Okay, let me get the lights up. I can't get those things. Lights on. Ah. Okay. Now let's consider the three-dimensional structure of our amino acids. I have my ball and stick model. Here's two amino acids. This is the alpha carbon right in the middle. Okay, I'm tell you, that's the way to think of it. And so this happens to be glycine. And so we have an amino group and a carboxyl group, let's say. And then there's a hydrogen, is the side chain, and then there's the common hydrogen of all of them. Right? And this is also glycine, but there's two hydrogens. So are these two molecules have to be identical? Well, in this case anyway, you can see that if I can superimpose them, well, let's see, I need these two together. I'm sure I can do it. There we go. These two are identical. But suppose I would change. Oh, no. Yeah, they're there. Suppose I would make this rather than glycine, we'll keep it simple and make alanine. Alanine was the one that just had the methyl group. We'll make it a different color, right? This is hydrogen and this is methyl. So I'm going to substitute a methyl group here and a methyl group here. And now we have a situation, kind of a special situation in chemistry, where we have four different identifiable groups attached to the same central carbon. So now, can I still line these up? I got the oranges. No, I don't have the greens. What do you think? Can I line these up? Well, let's see. Green, green, orange. Ah. I didn't do it right. I wanted to do it. All right, I'm going to try a little experiment here. I'm going to just change these randomly without thinking about it. I thought about it, I got in trouble, actually. I still not lined them up. Ah. Now they line up. I wanted to start this way. Then I would ask you, can I line them up? You say, no. And then I say, they did. They did line up. So why would you say no? It's because you know I'm talking about stereoisomers, because you've read it before. So you expect it, and so you gave me a knee-jerk reaction. This is not the way to think. Okay? So I still tell you the story, even though it would have been more effective if I had done it correctly the first time. All right, these are both alanine. But you saw, I had alanine before, so let's change. I'm going to change any two. Let's do the green. Should work. Didn't practice this particular way of doing it. I've changed the relationship of three-dimensional relationship of the some of these, each of two of these unique, they're all unique groups relative to the central atom. So now I've got the oranges and the green. No, these don't line up. And I put the browns and the greens, which is the ones I changed. Maybe that's. Now these don't line up. Well, the things I didn't change, I'll keep together. Now the green and the brown don't, because I've changed them, right? I changed them. So what is this? Is this alanine? Yes. Is this alanine? Yes. They're both alanine, because alanine is defined as having a carbon with an amino group, carboxyl group, a hydrogen, and a methyl group. And they both satisfy that criterion. But there's two different forms. Just like alpha and beta glucose, there's two different forms of three-dimensional space that we could conceive of right away and still call them alanine. So we have to give them an adjective. So we'll call this one, if you had just this pure, if you could separate these two, they're actually, you know, they're different in three-dimensional space. So with great difficulty, you can devise a way to actually separate these in an experiment and purify one away from the other. Then this could be then, if you look at a solution of this, because they're all, and we don't have to really understand this, but all these molecules, if you shine polarized light through that solution, they will bend the light. Light bends when it goes through solutions. You see that If you look at a spoon in a glass of water from the right angle. So it bends it to the right, let's say, as you're looking at it. It bends it to the right, to my right. And so we'll call it, not R for right, but we'll use the Latin dextro, right, for right. And so we'll call this one levo. Right? So this one is levo, we'll call it L-alanine. And this one is dextro, we'll call it D-alanine. So those are the terms we use instead of alpha and beta, except these are more tied, not arbitrary. They're tied to some kind of experiment. Right? So the amino acids can be in the D or the L form. Is this one L? You call it L because it's in my left hand, but I can't tell. I can't remember, you know, which is which. So that means what? How many amino acids could there be? Not 20, but 40. Wrong. Glycine, it didn't matter. Glycine didn't have this situation with four different groups. So there's no DNL glycine. I have to have four different groups in order to do this. I could change those outside balls to my heart's content with glycine. They will always be able to superimpose them. And I'll show you that. So there's 39, then, different amino acids that we can consider. 18 pairs of DNLs and glycine. So do proteins, then, have 39 amino acids? No, life is simpler. Life uses, for proteins, only the L amino acids. Forget about the D. So do we ever see D in nature? Yes, we see it sometimes, here and there. In bacterial cell wall, there's D serine, I think it is. D serine is used. And you know, why would you use one over the other? Well, see, three dimensions, so important, you know? Suppose I were to grab this molecule. If I grab this molecule, brown and green with my left and right hand, on some surface that does that, and hold it like this, I've got just that little old hydrogen sticking out. But if I grabbed, go ahead, left was brown, grab this one the same way, now I've got this methyl group sticking out. So it makes a big difference. I'm going to meet somebody who's looking for a methyl group. Here I have it sticking out, or there I didn't. So, again, three dimensions, very important. Seems lighter than it was. I said all this. There's the picture from Sadhava, which is quite pleasing, I think. And gives you the idea. The two are mirror images of each other. I won't belabor it. Let's go back for a minute. Think about those sugars. Here's our amino acids, which I just showed you in living color here, so we understand that. And any compound that's got four different groups. Are there any others we've talked about already? What about glucose, D-glucose here? Here's a, essentially this carbon, it's got four different groups around it, it's called asymmetric. Asymmetric because you can't put a plane through this molecule and have it look the same on both sides. How about this carbon? I should, I guess, use something with it. So C, O, and H. You could go through the middle of that H and the O and the C, and it would look the same on both sides. How about this one? This one satisfies this criterion. It's got this aldehyde group up here, a hydroxyl, a hydrogen, and the whole rest, or R, down here. This is an asymmetric carbon. And so we could have two forms of glucose. Another form of glucose, if that's OH, we're on the other side compared to this side. Remember, this has been smashed, flattened. In real life, these H and OH are coming out at you, and these bonds are going behind, which is the convention of this Fischer projection. So, in three-dimensional space, now, coming out at you here on your left is H, and your left is OH. It's different if I had OH coming out at you over here, and H coming out on this side, just like the amino acids are different. I deferred it because it's so complicated, it's a lot simpler for the amino acids. So there's at least two forms of glucose. Well, wait a minute. What about the third one? It's the same situation. We have this group on top, which is different from this group on the bottom, and the left and right is different again. So this is also asymmetric. So if we take the two forms of this, for each form of this, we could write two forms, depending on what The arrangement is around the third carbon. The fourth carbon, same thing. Fifth carbon, also asymmetric. Sixth carbon, no, we have two H's. All four of these middle carbons are asymmetric. So we could have two forms of this, times two forms of this, times two forms of this. 16 different isomers of glucose could be written. The one we're talking about is called D-glucose, but clearly D and L are not going to suffice here. We could write L-glucose, which is, in fact, the mirror image of D-glucose, and it's been nicely named L-glucose. It's just the mirror image of every point, every carbon is the opposite of what it is in D-glucose. But you could have all kinds of intermediate situations. Here's a case where it's only carbon 2 has a different configuration. Otherwise, it's the same as D-glucose. So what are we going to call that? Well, it was discovered before they even knew about this. So they called it mannose, because it came from manon, or from heaven, I don't know, manna. So mannose is one of these stereoisomers of D-glucose. It has a completely different name. Instead of D and L alanine, we have glucose and mannose, and galactose and allose. I don't have the slide for that. I gave you that slide already. And I just, at that time, I just said in the ring, look, the OH is up, the OH is down. But that's why. Right? So every time it folds, these OHs will have consequences for the ring as well, of course. Okay, let's get back to proteins and talk about, now that we know all about them as individual amino acids, any exam that will require you to look at amino acid structure, you'll get the handout, same handout you have now, which shows all the amino acid structures but does not show you in the charge on them. That you have to figure out, because it comes from the memorization of those functional groups and drives you to remember them. Again, we'll have a dehydration reaction. We'll take amino acid 1, we'll just call this side chain R1 and this one R2, and we'll connect them. We're going to make 3 connections over here first, maybe even more. All right, we just made these 3. Next one will be more. Now we can start talking about the parts of this tri-amino acid. Actually, we have a name for this macromolecule, and it gets a little confusing. I told you we're talking about proteins, but there's something called polypeptides. When you connect 2 amino acids together, you form, first of all, an amide bond. So it's no longer a COOH, it's no longer an NH2. It's an amide, which you know now is not charged, but it's highly polar, it's not charged. And this, when you connect 2 amino acids, it's called, you've formed a peptide. If there's 2 amino acids, it's called a dipeptide, tripeptide, tetrapeptide, oligopeptide, polypeptide. So polypeptide is a general term for stringing a whole bunch of amino acids together in a line. Where does the protein come in? Protein could be a polypeptide, but protein could be a little more complicated. Protein could be 2 polypeptides that associate with each other. So protein is a more global term. But polypeptide means one covalently bound string of amino acids, bound always by this amide. This amide bond, if it's in a polypeptide, is also called a peptide bond. So it's given a special name besides just amide. The peptide bond is an amide bond. Not all amide bonds will be peptide bonds if they're not connecting 2 amino acids. It could be connecting some carboxylic acid to some amine. Here it is a little, from your handout, 3.3. And we can talk, we're going to name different parts of the molecule again so we can talk about it. First of all, there's a polarity here because I've drawn it so that the amino group is free here, and I've added the second amino acid to the carboxyl group coming in from the right. So I end up with a carboxyl group on the right and an amino group on the left, and that is the convention. So we could go to further abbreviations. You talk about abbreviations. If I'm talking about polypeptides and I just draw a straight horizontal line, I said, well, this is the polypeptide. So then you can, by convention, take it for granted the amino group is on the left and the carboxyl group is on the right, and I haven't indicated any of the side chains, but I've just indicated this line is probably, and I'm going to go on and do something with it. So that's the ultimate abbreviation. This is shown charged. So every polypeptide in solution will have, if its ends are free like this, it will have a charged amino terminal or amino end and a charged carboxyl terminal or carboxy end or carboxyl end, all the same. Within the molecule, we can identify again the amide bond. We can also see what's left of the amino acid in here, which is indeed most of it. There's what the NH2 was. I'm on handout 3.3. And on the right is that CO, which is what's left of the COOH. So this is missed, the amino group is missing one H, and the carboxyl group is missing an OH, where the water was taken out. And so this residue of the amino acid is called just that, as it is generally in polymers. This is the residue of the monomer that's incorporated and as seen inside the polymer. It also might be called a repeating unit. And they differ then only by the side chains. Oh, one more term. Sometimes it's convenient to forget about these side chains. Even that's what's given the molecule its beauty and its functionality. But sometimes we just want to talk about all the atoms except forget about the side chains. And especially if we're talking about how this is arranged in three-dimensional space. That's called the backbone. So the backbone doesn't have the side chains. I said this. There's the backbone. With just the R's left out. So you can see it's very monotonous without the backbone. It's without the side chains. It's the side chains that give the variety to these proteins. What are some of these proteins? They have different jobs. Egg albumin is a single long polypeptide about 500 amino acids long. That's the egg white. Right? Hemoglobin courses through your veins and red blood cells. It's used to bind oxygen as you breathe, exchanges in the lungs. Keratin is a structural protein. It's used to make hair and fingernails. Estrogen receptor, it's a protein that's in the cytoplasm, and when those estrogen worms its way through by itself into the cytoplasm, it can bind up with this protein and that can start a cascade of signals. Immunoglobulins are antibodies are immunoglobulins. This is the more chemical name for it, and they help fight disease. They're in your bloodstream. Enzymes. These are the guys who are underneath all the arrows in that flow of glucose diagram, and that catalyze chemical reactions. For example, beta-galactosidase is the name of one particular enzyme. It takes a beta-galactoside, which is galactose linked by a beta linkage to something else, like another sugar, like lactose, for example, and it hydrolyzes it. The ACE usually means hydrolysis, but not always. And so the enzymes are sometimes named in a way that helps you understand what they do, and sometimes they have historical names which tell you nothing. Each particular protein polymer, a polypeptide, it has a unique sequence of the amino acids. For instance, it could be methionine, alanine, leucine, arginine, glutamate, leucine, valine, etc. If you look at one molecule of albumin, egg albumin, let's say, it will have that particular sequence. Now, how do we know this sequence? It seems rather complicated. It's one thing to look at polysaccharides, they're so monotonous. But here, you can have 500 different amino acids. How do we know what the sequence is? Indeed, it's the sequence of these amino acids, as well as their character, that determines the functionality of the protein. Right. At this point, as we will a couple of times, maybe several times during the semester, we're going to take some time to talk about laboratory methodology. And there's two reasons for this. One is to give you an idea of how some of these things were discovered. We don't have too much time for this, and we present you a lot of this story as a lot of facts, try to weave them together in an interesting way. But the experiments behind it are often, there's no time for it. That's one reason. And to give you a little taste of what it's like to do laboratory research. A second reason, which is really the more important reason, I think, is that when we consider the manipulation of these molecules in the laboratory, you get to know the molecules in a more intimate way. And to see their behavior, you'll be able to connect this, oh, this is polar, oh, this is charged. And you'll be able to see the consequences of those memorized functional group characterizations. And it's really more for that, I think, than for this taste of the lab. So we're going to take, I'm going to show you an old technique for determining the what these, in this very short oligopeptide with an N end, no, I shouldn't have to draw it, and a C end, how are they determined? For this peptide, we use another protein, an enzyme, which is will catalyze, help catalyze a chemical reaction, and this is called carboxypeptidase. Beautifully named. It's a peptidase, means it's going to hydrolyze a peptide bond. Not anywhere, but only at the carboxyl end of a polypeptide. So it's only going to go here. It needs to see this end, probably that charged carboxyl group. Right? Grabs that and then goes over here and adds water to this group, and so you get this red guy coming off, which is now separate. And you can separate this. Let's say you attach this end to some kind of bead, and so it's not free in solution, but this end is dangling, and now you add the carboxypeptidase, and in the first few seconds then, or you'll get from all of them, sort of synchronously, all these molecules, you'll get this first one comes out, you wash it down and collect it in a tube. Then the reaction goes a little further, and you'll take, then the second one will come off. Right? So if this guy was Sarah would come off first, and then Asp would come off, and then glue's going to come off, and you should have these. Yes. So we collect that in a tube, and collect that a few seconds later. And to the extent that we can maintain this synchrony, we can determine, if we look in these tubes and figure out what amino acid it is, we can get from the end the sequence. Unfortunately, this it might be 99.9% synchronous for the first one. For the next one, it's also, say, 99.9, but now it's 99.9 times 99.9. By the time you get to the 19th or 20th one, it starts to get some are a little lagging, some went ahead a little faster, and you can't tell what's going on. But you know, even if you get the majority, the great majority, like 60% was leucine over here, you could assign it. That's the one. But then, so you can do 20, let's say. I'm not sure. Now, it's one thing to separate and put them in tubes, and I say, well, then you identify it. So how do you identify it? Usually to identify small molecules or any molecules, you need to separate them one from the other and look at their characteristic behavior. In this case, we can separate them, say, based on charge. How cool are the different characters for these different amino acids? So one is charged. There's several of the amino acids are charged. Right? We're in charge of the pH now in the laboratory. And so we can use something like electrophoresis, which is going to separate molecules on the basis of their charge. So we'll continue with these a couple more laboratory methods and then return to the three-dimensional structure of proteins next time.